Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UA Little Rock Public Radio. The harp is very much part of modern musical programming and also a vital inspiration to contemporary composers, a voice appealing to much music. But there is no doubt the image of the instrument, the stories and early music take many of us back in time beyond our childhood, to lands of myth and romance. So, to listen to Irish harpist Morani Hathasek tell us more of the lands that cherish it still for preserving the instrument, its music, and how it is played, is special. And I hope the following conversation will raise awareness and curiosity. You're from County Cork, but your husband's from Yorkshire, so you met in Yorkshire or in County Cork?
Neither. We actually met at a festival in Spain, playing on my own. I was playing as a soloist, and Chris was accompanying a singer.
And what was he accompanying the singer with?
Guitar. He's a guitarist.
Ah. Now, do you and he play your instruments together and perform when you're touring?
Yes, we do. That's what we do, yes. We've been doing that now for a very long time, for 30 years, actually.
Now, tell me, do you write your own music?
We do, and we play a lot of traditional music as well. Traditional music from Ireland and traditional music from Scotland. A lot of things that we've composed ourselves. And Chris's background, my background was in traditional music and also classical music, but Chris's background was in improvised forms of music, swing jazz particularly. And he also is very interested in bluegrass. And he's an extremely good improviser. So when we got together, we had totally different musical backgrounds. So he had to learn my music, and I had to learn his.
And you?
So we do our concert is a sort of mixture of both, really. There's a lot of traditional things, and then there are a lot of things we've composed in different styles, and then there are a few swing things and a few bluegrass things as well. So Chris gets to improvise. So it's always fun for me because he just does something different every night. I never know what he's going to do, so...
Does he expect you to chime in when he's improvising so that there are areas where what you would be playing or could play when you were picking up what he was doing that just sounded perfect?
No, well, it's always, when he's improvising, it's always over a set harmonic sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So all I've got to do is stick to the harmonic sequence.
Ah.
Yeah. So then he just works over that. Yeah.
Now, the songs themselves, do you take them from ready-made poetry or write your own scripts?
It's an instrumental concert. I used to sing many years ago, but I don't at the moment because I've had some problems with my voice. So it's an instrumental evening. And so we do pieces from, as I said, from all those different styles that I mentioned. So
now, the guitarist, does he play just the one guitar or does he have several that he switches between? And then you have just the one harp?
I have just the one harp, but on the concert he plays just one guitar. We only tour with one guitar. It's just such a nightmare trying to bring other things. Chris is a great mandolin player as well. And all our CDs always have mandolin on them, but he doesn't really tour with it. He also plays bass and various other things as well, which you could hear on our recordings.
Yeah.
But he doesn't tour with them because it's just too much of a nightmare, really. You don't want to be touring with too much stuff. I mean, quite a number of years ago, we used to tour with the mandolin, and once we just left it behind. And I thought, this is just, it's just too easy for things like that to happen. You've got one instrument each, you're less likely to forget things or to, you know.
Oh, it's bad enough with luggage.
Yeah.
So just out of interest, trying to imagine the size and quality of your instruments, the Irish harp is one you hold in your arms.
No.
No.
It's floor standing. And it's smaller than a pedal harp, which is the orchestral harp.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, I don't know, about half the size, maybe more than half, actually, about three quarters of the size of a pedal harp. I sit when I play. I sit in a normal chair, and so the bottom part of the harp is pretty much the same size as the part that goes up against your shoulder. Is only marginally bigger than a pedal harp, and it's just the front is extended upwards to accommodate the extra strings.
So how many?
I play a harp with 36 strings. And the smallest pedal harp, I think, has about 42 or something like that. So, the main difference really is that pedal harps have pedals to change key, and mine have levers, which it's like a manual version of the same thing, really.
So, do you use it? Whereabouts would be your hand? Would your hand be in the middle of where you would be playing, so that you can adjust quickly?
My hands. My right arm, my right hand plays the melody, my left hand plays the accompaniment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you normally play in the middle of the strings to get the best tone. That's the normal thing you do with a harp, any kind of harp.
And then the harp sequence is the same as the guitar?
No, it's not. The harp is like a piano.
Yes.
In that way, it's tuned like a piano, like the white notes on a piano. Many people tune their harps to E flat. I like to tune mine to F. There's a kind of historical reason for that, really, in that I don't know whether you know anything about the history of the modern orchestral harp, but the modern orchestral harp is actually what they call it's entirely chromatic. It's a double action harp, so every the pedal controls a particular string. It has three sort of notches that the pedal can be at. One for sharp, natural, and flat. In the 18th century, they had a single action harp, which was which had only two positions up and down. In other words, natural and sharp, or whatever you want, however you wanted to do it. And the harp that I play is kind of like a mechanized version of. It's kind of like a manual version of that of the single action harp. The history of the Irish harp for the back is very, very different. But from the beginning of the 19th century, Irish harps became much more like what they were in the rest of Europe, and so they took on the many people took on the same tuning system that they used for the single action harp, which was tuning in E flat. But if you don't play much in E flat, there's no point. So I like to a lot of traditional music I heard from Ireland and Scotland is in sharp keys rather than flat keys. So I've therefore tune in F. So I have lots and lots of access to a lot of sharp keys. It's quite interesting, really. I mean, the old Irish harp was strung with brass and played with the nails, and that the earliest references to that are in 595 AD, a very, very long time ago. And that harp continued to be played right throughout the Middle Ages, in fact, right as far as the beginning of the 19th century, when people started to play the more modern Irish harp, which was constructed in a modern manner and played with the flesh of the fingers, and strung and played, tuned the way I've described. So there's a lot of continuity, but it was a very different change as well in the early 19th century in the actual type of harp that was played.
So how is the guitar tuned that you can work together?
Well, it's tuned in intervals. It's tuned E, B, G, D, A, and E.
So it's like the other string instruments. It's like the other string instruments, cello and violin.
Yes. So Chris creates his notes.
Yeah.
I don't create my notes. They're there for me. Chris creates his notes from the intervals that he's got.
So is the Welsh harp one that's carried in the arm?
No, it's not. It's floor standing as well. I don't know any of any harps that are carried in the arms except tiny ones that you see in medieval paintings. pretty much all harps are floor standing. The Welsh harp what people generally consider now to be the Welsh harp is the triple harp, which is has three courses of strings, and that's pretty big and heavy and awkward.
Yeah.
That's floor standing too.
Well, it sort of ruined an image I had of these Irish and Welsh harps. I was thinking of David the Bard on his bed of death lies, pale are his features and dim his eyes.
Yes, there is no, you see them in sort of paintings, of biblical paintings and stuff, but there aren't any actual harps, certainly that are played these days, which, you know, resemble those at all. Even in the medieval period, I mean, the Irish harp, the oldest actual Irish harp that we have that's still in existence, it dates from the 14th century, and it's preserved in Trinity College in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very beautiful, and it would have been incredibly expensive to make at the time. And that's actually the image that's used on our coinage and on all of the documents that you get from this state, the Irish state. The Irish state owns the copyright on that image. So it's on our coinage, it's on tax demands, it's on all official documents in Ireland have that harp on them. And it's quite big. In fact, the Irish harp was the largest instrument in medieval Europe, apart from the organ. So elsewhere in Europe, the harps were quite a lot smaller. They still wouldn't have been held in the hands, really. There still would have been floor standing, which you would have had to kneel to play them. With the Irish harp that's played in the 14th century was actually reasonably big. And as time went on, they got bigger. By the time you got to the 18th century in Ireland, they were really very big. They were pretty much the same sort of size as the contemporary single action pedal harps that you would have found elsewhere in Europe.
So the wandering minstrels, who had a name for their minstrelsy and their music, they would be playing the harp, but they would have somebody like a young boy behind them trying to help handle them.
Exactly, that's exactly it. Yes, the harp, the whole wandering minstrel thing didn't really happen with harps, certainly not in Ireland, because Irish harpers were actually had a very high status in society, and they always had a servant to carry a harp for them. One of the interesting things about it is that, you know, all of the Ireland, like Scotland in the medieval period, was a collection of small kingdoms, or in which every chieftain of a clan had his own hereditary court poet and his own hereditary court harper. And both the poets and the harpers, as I said, were very well paid and of high status and everything. But the harps were quite ornate and very expensive, and also you needed to play them with long nails. There was no question of sort of popping to the supermarket and getting false nails. So you had to mind your nails. You couldn't do any sort of manual work at all. You couldn't even wash your own clothes or make your own food or do anything like that. So you always, if you were a professional harp player in Ireland or in Scotland too, you always had a servant to do all that sort of thing for you. Because you had to preserve your nails and keep them perfect for your playing.
So all you did as the performer was just wait and have a wonderful time and play beautiful music.
Yes. Well, the old Irish harpers had a very, very good time, and they did in Scotland too. I mean, the Scottish clans were, as the farther you go back in time, the closer the Irish way of life was to the Scottish way of life. I mean, it was pretty much the same in the medieval period. They had the same language and the same music, really, and the same harp, too.
Well, history tells us that the Scots came from Ireland.
Originally, yes. The Latin word Scotus actually means Irish person.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, dear, what history does.
Yeah, I know, it's interesting.
And what we do with history.
I'm fascinated by all of that, as you can hear, I'm sure.
Yes, no, I think.
It's a question, I give you lots of information.
I think you need to, because, you know, you're waiting for us to come and listen to you playing, and not to do it over the radio.
I love to play, we play a wide variety of music, as I said. Well, we do play some old music. The concert that we do actually straddles quite a few centuries. You know, we play some 17th century music, some 18th century music, 19th century music, 20th century music, and 21st century music. So, complete variety.
Wonderful. Well, I think that is perfect for people listening to say, well, we'll come and hear them in Little Rock.
Lovely. We're really, really looking forward to it.
Thank you. And I'm looking forward to seeing you and remembering that I was the one who didn't remember.
Yes, the man, yes.
With the introduction and music at the start of this art scene program, followed by Moira Ní Hafásaigh's description of something she knows and loves so well, the next thing is to see it happen. Moira and her husband, guitarist Chris Newman, will be presented by the Little Rock Folk Club, 7:30 on November the 4th, in the Hibernia Irish Tavern, 9700 North Rodney Parham Road. For more information, call 501-663-0634. The first time I heard this music, from Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, it gripped me almost physically, and any time it's played, when I catch even a phrase of the music, it stops me dead in my tracks. Talking with Philip Mann last July about the 1718 masterwork season, and we came to number 3. He was full of enthusiasm because of the Prokofiev Romeo and Juliet. He is my guest today. And Philip, I was curious to know why you have this particular connection to Prokofiev and this particular piece.
Oh, that's a fantastic question, Anne. I appreciate it. And thank you so much again for having me on your show. It is always just a delight, and I look forward to it tremendously. When we were speaking about this program, there's probably a few different reasons why I get excited. And the first you mentioned is the repertoire. But before I even speak in specifics about the repertoire, I should mention that, you know, once a year, I make a conscious effort to try to make the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra the soloists on a program. We put the spotlight on the orchestra and really make them the stars of the show. And that's why this connection of the repertoire is exciting for me, because one, it highlights the orchestra, and two, it highlights them in a repertoire that I feel strongly about and just excites me. And the Prokofiev Second Suite of Romeo and Juliet is an orchestral showpiece. It is spectacular in its orchestration. It has this great ingenuity and genius in its collection and connection between themes that are related in how they're constructed. So you have things like the Montagues and the Capulets, which is one of the most rousing moments in Western music, this great feud between the two families in Verona depicted in music. But then when we get to meet the young Juliet, we realize that Juliet's theme is actually thematically connected to the Capulet's theme. Of course, makes very much sense when you think about it from a literary perspective, but this great connection and this nuance in the structure of the work gives it a cohesiveness that is quite compelling as an interpreter of the music. When I think about the excitement, though, perhaps, that it's these great balletic moments where you have the big fight scene.
But what wanted to know, a personal point of view from you, What was your first reaction, the very first time you heard this piece or saw it? And was it the ballet you saw first or in an orchestra concert?
For me, it was playing in an orchestra performance.
Let's just talk a little bit about your comment when we talked about the season last July.
Yeah.
You said that you were waiting until the orchestra was ready for it.
Yes.
What did you mean?
Well, I think often long term, when I think of programming, where we are musically together with respect to our maturity, with respect to the relationship between the orchestra and myself, and also just purely about where we are in our artistic trajectory together, what an orchestra is capable of playing at a very, very high level. And I feel strongly, and I'm so encouraged with the quality of the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra right now, that it's beginning to open up new programmatic possibilities where we can really dive in and perform at a very high level some of the great and most technically challenging and demanding works of people like Strauss, Mahler, Prokofiev. And this ballet score is particularly challenging because it highlights almost in a classical kind of way, almost in the way you might find in someone like Haydn, individual instruments in exposed and very, in just direct fashion. So it requires a great deal of trust from a conductor in the talents of his or her principal musicians, but also in this case, some of the auxiliary musicians that are featured, the Prokofiev, and indeed, we'll hear saxophone as a featured instrument as well. So it's a reflection on the depth of our musicianship right now and really on the health of the artistic trajectory of where we are together. There's also a certain quality of Prokofiev that I find lends to a sense of event. I mean, he has this specific voice, this tangy coloring character that for me, it has a power and a newness to it that, you know, in his own words, I think he was trying to create this new voice that would be the voice of modernity that very clearly would diverge from the two primary voices of the time, which would have been Stravinsky and Schoenberg, the two giants of the time. Prokofiev was searching for a slightly different type of sound that might provide a different soundtrack for modernity. And this type of sound is very much on display in Romeo and Juliet.
So of other performances and other actual programs about Romeo and Juliet, both straight plays and other composers' approach to the wonderful story that you sometimes feel needs to be left alone because it's been set to so many things so often, but it still comes through what the story was, what Shakespeare had in mind when he wrote it, and the individual producers and dramatists who play with it are usually, by the end of the performance, towing the line with what Shakespeare meant.
That's right. And one thing that I find fascinating is that in Prokofiev's original conception of the ballet, he was considering not having the lovers die at the conclusion. And one reason why I love doing the second suite in its original form, without adding additional movements or the final scene from the ballet, similarly to what I did with Swan Lake recently of Tchaikovsky, is that one is left at the end of the second suite with this scene of Romeo's grave and Juliet awakening. And the answer is not actually given to the listener on whether or not Juliet will be stopped by the friar. So you don't actually know whether the two lovers will live happily ever after, and that their murders and suicides have been stopped, or that in fact we get the conclusion that we all grow up reading in Shakespeare. And there's also another connection with this work and the rest of the program that I'm intrigued by, and that's that the Prokofiev is seen as equally an orchestral piece as it is a ballet, whereas the symphonic dances of Rachmaninoff were always conceived of as an orchestral piece, but their original intention was that they would also then be performed as a ballet, as was his Paganini Variations, one of the most successful ballets of the time. So both of these works have kind of a dual role with different types of voices of modernity, and they literally were written within 5 years of each other, as was the Cavalleschi. So there's all kinds of interesting kind of temporal connections between these, and also the dual role of the stage and the orchestra pit.
So are you trying anything that's lain in your mind that you want to do with this particular work and have never done before?
Could you ask the question again, Anne? I'm sorry.
Well, is there anything in this work that you feel so passionately about that you have the orchestra up to the standard that you have been waiting for just so that you can put this work on? Has anything been in the back of your mind to try something that you've not heard anybody else do before, but think from your point of view, your idea might be expected because it is going to be different?
Well, one would hope that every, you know, performance has a sense of newness to it, but I won't say that we're making a large innovation or something with this masterworks performance. I think to pull off the dashing brilliance of the orchestration and the technical demands, I mean, this is what we were shooting for, but at the same time, with like the conclusion where you have this intimacy with very high playing in things like the first violins and just kind of dangerous exposure that lends itself to this notion of kind of the fallibility of life and time and all this stuff that just grabs our heartstrings because of how vulnerable in a way that the sound is in the orchestra. This is one of the reasons why it is such a great challenge, but why it gives us so much more back if we're successful in that challenge. There are pieces that are special to me that I simply am waiting for the right opportunity. I mean, another work like that that you and I have discussed in the past, very important work to my repertoire that I look forward to sharing with audiences, would be something like Schubert's Ninth Symphony, the great C major symphony. So these are works that I'm looking for the right time in our journey together for the orchestra and I to tackle new challenges.
One of the things that I wanted to talk about were things like Romeo and Juliet that everybody knows from Romantic times.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they treat the bird, the nightingale. No, it's not the nightingale. And what Prokofiev does for that is equally, and I think almost better than the romantic one, who is what, Gounod?
I think it's brilliant, and I think that it's absolutely what one would expect from Prokofiev when you look at, you know, his approach to the kind of.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I hope this interview will bring to the audience an awareness of why you want to do it now and what this means to you, and that you hope will come over the footlights when you're in performance with this in the third Masterworks concert.
I do hope so, and I think our audiences are going to enjoy a very special program. I mean, even the overture of about a 16th century carpenter has an interesting connection to Shakespeare's time, and then the notion of the medieval quotations and Rachmaninoff. The interconnections of this program are so fascinating to me, but to pull it off with the brilliance and panache that I think we're capable of now is what I'm really looking forward to experiencing.
The third Arkansas Symphony Orchestra Masterworks concert is close upon us, and after Philip Mann's explanation what he and the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra will present November 3rd and 4th in Robinson Performing Arts Center, in the matinee performance, students K through high school are admitted free with a ticketed adult. Expect packed houses. And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UA Little Rock Public Radio.